Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're going to be talking with Julie Palmer. She's the executive director of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. Obviously, a huge issue, a lot to talk about. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure. And unfortunately, we have to talk about a serious topic. And I guess right off the bat, let me just ask you from a perception standpoint. I know you spend a lot of time with outreach and education, but at the same time, is the issue of human trafficking, is it well known and understood well enough?
Well, that's a really great question. Well, I think part of our efforts is the education piece. And we find that when we do presentations, more than half the room hasn't heard about it, or those that have not understood how it affects Western New York. So I definitely think there is more need to share what it's about, how it's affecting us in our communities, because it's going to look different in Western New York than it might look in the border,
okay,
a third world country, you know, what we might see in movies. And so I think that is really important, too, for us to understand how we could see it in our communities, how people can be more aware. We often have people, once they're educated, bring tips, you know, and be able to acknowledge what's happening in their own communities, help with prevention, be more aware and intervene sooner. So there's positive and good things out of understanding the topic and knowing what it is. We don't have to be afraid of it. We just have to really know what's going on around us and be really proactive.
So what does it look like here in our community in Western New York? Or is there maybe a couple of different pictures depending on where we are in this region?
Yeah, well, it's really important first that we talk about how human trafficking is defined. So there was legislation in 2000 called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And what that did was establish the more defining of the topic of human trafficking, also to better prosecute perpetrators and help serve victims. And so in that, it is the recruiting, harboring, or transporting a person solely for the purpose of commercial sex or forced labor. So what does that all mean? Recruiting. It can be any means to engage somebody. It can be enticing them, engaging them, and then harboring does not have to mean kidnapping. A lot of our clientele are not kidnapped right now. A lot of them are held either psychologically, manipulating their vulnerabilities, taking them to different locations to do different acts. And transporting, again, doesn't have to be state lines, international lines. It just means, for example, maybe somebody's going from Jamestown to Buffalo to Rochester and doing different acts. Maybe they're literally just going to a house in the community of our suburbs and doing an act. Maybe they're in a forced labor situation working on site somewhere. So it really just means they're in a location being exploited. And in order for it to be a crime in the eyes of the law, they look for force, fraud, or coercion. And that's a really important piece. And there, the government had established human trafficking intervention courts across the country. Buffalo actually has one, and we work with them in collaboration. And the goal is when the community, maybe there's an arrest or another court, gets an individual and they see that perhaps there was force, fraud, or coercion in their circumstance, they send them to that court with the hopes that we can do more intervention, maybe vacate their crime, help them get services, help them get away from the situation. And so force, you know, violence, threat of violence. We have clients, we had a teen who told us that she would leave her her house and go do commercial sex acts because they threatened her three younger siblings. You know, so just the idea of the threat. We had a client tell us that she was put in a situation where, you know, they intoxicated her and she was gang raped 19 times in 24 hours. Just the violent act against her. Some that have broken jaws, individuals stabbed, you know, things that leave the people we serve either violently offended, or that threat that something's going to happen to them or someone they care about keeps them engaged, unfortunately. Fraud, maybe somebody gets a job. You know, we have hear of people coming from other cities into our region. They see an ad, a massage parlor, some type of work, farming community. They go to it, and then they're being asked to do things that they weren't being, that they weren't originally told. Maybe there was sex acts involvement. Maybe they get to a work site and they say, well, we'll give you a place to live, but if you don't stay on the job, we're going to kick you out of the house. Maybe they'll say, hey, you're not documented to be here, we'll get you deported. You know, just different things that they do, fraudulent. And then coercion is the other piece. And we see that so much with people's circumstances, you know, indicators, vulnerabilities, you know, maybe people need housing. So, you know, they're desperate. We had an individual that got in a cab and told the driver she had no place to go. He offered his place and then days later said, this is how you're going to pay your rent, and brought men in, you know. And so people get in circumstances, you know. We had somebody share with us that, you know, she was living an average life like all of us, family, job, got into a bad situation with a boyfriend, got her addicted, and then spiraled, got her involved in prostitution and all these things and exploitative acts, and, you know, just gets in these circumstances that sometimes people don't choose, but was going through a loss, going through some trials, and, you know, got into this addiction. And often we see that too, where perpetrators will use addiction. You know, so we hear clients a lot tell us they had no idea what happened to them, that they didn't realize what they were even taking. And then they're assaulted, and then it gets recorded. And then there'll be threat of, we'll expose you if you don't come back again. You know, just all these things, or sometimes teens are using, maybe even something as simple as a vape, a dab pen, you know, smoking marijuana, but they'll lace it. They'll get them so they won't even remember what's happened. And so we're seeing these tactics that coerce and manipulate people. And then unfortunately, they get caught up in something they don't know how to get away from.
The one of the perceptions, I think, of human trafficking, and I think based on the way you're describing some of these examples, that they are very well could be involving just people who grew up here in Western New York and average. It's not necessarily somebody who is coming from a foreign country for whatever reason. So this is really happening right here. A suburban kid, just to put someone out there, or an adult, finds themselves in a circumstance like this.
100%. We did for some of the funding we receive, we've tracked our zip codes that we've served over the, we're entering our 10th year of providing services to victims. And when we did the zip codes, we served almost every zip code in Erie County, some in Niagara County, Chautauqua County, Genesee County, and a lot of suburbs. We do transportation services. We're picking up youth from school districts all over the community. You know, it's just things that we don't realize is happening and how it's affecting the community, that it's just kind of a hidden crime. Sure. Is what I would say, you know, and youth, especially with the advancement of technology and device use, you know, that has advanced. We know that remote learning took place, and we got on Chromebooks and phones and social media and internet, and they're doing so much research now to look at that and its impact. I mean, there was one recent I was reading into about the increase in anxiety and depression and the fear of missing out on things and what that's doing to kids and how tied they are to those devices. Well, if you're a perpetrator, that's a beautiful way to engage. Why go to a location if you know everybody's on a device? I was in a training with the FBI's Child Exploitation Unit. They were talking about Discord and how the increase of exploitation on that, it's like a gaming chat system. It's very anonymous. You use aliases. You change it every 30 days. You often don't know who you're talking to. They're getting kids to send explicit photos. And then they're saying, if you don't do send me $200, we're going to share this photo. So it's like a double crime. And then they were saying that a lot of these individuals are in foreign countries where the U.S. has no jurisdiction.
Okay.
You know, so it's a very thought out crime. And unfortunately, the internet has allowed for it to expand in that way. And as we know, internet's always, there's good too, right? There's a lot of great things we've accomplished in society,
right,
with the advancement of technology. And unfortunately, there's always people that are going to find ways to manipulate it for bad.
And you did mention a possibility of maybe going to, like you said, like a farming community or a farm, mm-hmm, or something along those lines. Is that something, again, trying to peel it back here and really understand, yeah, what we're talking about, that's something that's happened in this region?
Yeah, actually, I did a training years and years ago. Homeland Security talked about a whole case where they had rescued over 100 migrants in a farming community in Western New York region. And they serve, I believe, I don't know, like, we serve the 8 counties of Western New York. I believe they serve like the 16
right
counties. It's pretty expansive. So And now, you know, we're a refugee resettlement city. We're now having the migrant community in our region. And so, unfortunately, people are going to take advantage of those circumstances. You know, and we had an individual years ago that came in the community. She didn't know the language very well, didn't understand labor laws, employment, and somebody got her cleaning hotel rooms 8 hours and only paying her $50 under the table. You know, it's just a lot of that. And then the threat of, if you don't continue doing this, we're going to tell people, you know, you're not working legitimate, you're not paying taxes. So they'll do the spin, you know, to get people kind of feeling like they're coerced into it.
We are talking this morning on What's Next with Julie Palmer, the executive director of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. Where do you want the focus to be on? The victim or the perpetrator? Do we need to keep our eyes on both, or do we really first and foremost have to understand and appreciate what victims are going through?
I would think it would be the latter for us. And that's what most of our work focuses on, is those that are victimized and how we serve them. And what we do is educate in ways that people could be victimized, what perpetrators are attempting to do to victimize individuals. I think that the law enforcement side, the district attorneys and U.S. attorneys, they're the ones that are really looking at, how do we criminalize this behavior? How do we prosecute this behavior? And, you know, it's a arduous task.
I was just going to say, I mean, I'm wondering about that, is, like you said, and maybe this is why it's probably better to, just to keep an eye on keep that focus on the victims, because it does sound like this is something that doesn't have a lot of a paper trail involved to it in a lot of cases,
mm-hmm,
and perhaps a lot of, personal testimony rather than, mm-hmm, you know, group testimony about things. So it can be a difficult thing to prosecute.
Absolutely can. Yeah, they need victim testimony. They need evidence of it. They need an exchange of something. You know, that's one of the important pieces with the commercial sex. There has to be an exchange of the sex for something. You know, it could be food, it could be shelter, it could be a substance, you know. But yeah, unfortunately, at times there is that challenge of, how do we find that evidence? How do we get that testimony? You know, these people have been through a lot of trauma, you know, and then of course we want that testimony so we can get the case, but these individuals aren't even sure how to get up and get through the day,
right,
sometimes, you know, so it's challenging for everybody involved.
So let's focus then on the victims, and you actually, it's maybe a chance now to maybe get into the story behind PATH and its formation, because you came out of the mental health counseling field,
yes,
and it led you into this. So why don't we get into that just a little bit?
Yeah. So the first half of my career was behavioral health, also music therapy. I did counseling, mental health counseling. I also was able to do music therapy services. And in that period, had my kids, took a little time to be mom, and I heard somebody speak about human trafficking in the faith community. And I thought, wow, how do I have a master's from UB? I've been doing behavioral health and I'm not hearing about this. And so it really just piqued my interest, kind of heard stories, really elicited an emotional reaction out of me. And I thought, wow, you know, I've worked in hospice, dying children, you know, why this issue? And just really felt kind of as a person of faith, it was something I was to step in and really try to get engaged. But frankly, at that time, my mind thought, what in the world would I do about this? You know, I mean, it's nice I have a master's in counseling, but it doesn't necessarily mean I know how to combat human trafficking.
Right, right, right.
So my approach and just style in life is you need to learn. And so I educated myself. I learned more. And I ended up going to an awareness coalition meeting where the individual leading said, hey, listen, I don't have time to propel this and move this along. But if somebody in the room feels led to get involved, let me know. And so that was kind of a little crisis moment for me.
Right.
You know, is this the thing to move in? And so her and I met and, you know, she shared with me some of the knowledge she had in the network. And then I just really went forward with it in 2012 and just educated myself locally, nationally, learned what others were doing, got training, and then kind of looked at our community and said, okay, what is a gap? What is an area that's not being filled in the needs of victims? And really saw an area where we could do kind of a holistic model approach of providing some of those therapeutic models, looking at, you know, what are ways people can restore and address their traumas. And so that's when our Enrichment Center was established in 2015. So we're now in our 10th year of services, and we've served almost 1,000 people.
So let's, we can't say there's a typical victim of human trafficking. I don't think that would be respectful. But at the same time, you know, what are, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is trust. I mean, I would think a person who comes to you looking for help, the first thing they've got to be have almost no trust in systems and in institutions.
That's right.
So how do you overcome that just off the start?
Yeah, it's a great question. That's actually a great point. And I would say that's 100%. Most of the people we serve come in doubting, for sure. I think what I really say to my team is, you know, we have licensed professionals doing intensive case management, counseling support, crisis safety interventions, professionals doing art and music therapies. We're doing work readiness. We have physicians doing medical care on site, trauma groups. And, you know, programming and good services is always something that is important to me, especially being that I'm in the field. But I've also learned from our clients, who are the ones we learn most from, is that it is often the relationship they're looking for first.
Okay.
And so I think that is really key, and it's strengths-based, right? It's to your point of how do we demonstrate our regard for them and not just be words, right? Not just speak something or say something, but how do we act it out? And so that's really something that our team does very well. It's something a part of our culture. It's not just what we say and do, but it's how we conduct ourselves, how we genuinely care for people. And so it's interesting when we do client surveys or we have an advisory group of clients that meet twice a year. It's interesting their feedback. It's interesting what they took from our services. And it's things I never would have thought about.
Okay.
And it's not always things you can quantify, right? Like funders want, we got to quantify.
Of course. Right.
But they'll say, you know, I felt like I experienced love for the first time at PATH. I felt like I experienced people actually caring and not just being a provider that says they're going to do something they're not going to do. You know, people I could trust and share my story and know I wasn't judged. Like those are really key things that we don't tend to quantify, right? But that was part for them, what caused them to want to rehabilitate. And I think that's really important part of the work, the trauma-informed care piece and being really knowledgeable. It's how we look at people. It's not why do they act this way? It's what happened to them. It's understanding their story. It's understanding what they've gone through. A lot of the clientele we serve had abusive childhoods, neglectful situations, didn't have good models for them in life, right? And part of the beauty of what we've seen our organization be able to do kind of organically is because of the way we're structured. We have 3 group days a week, and we don't put a limit on client attendance. So we don't rely on HMO, Medicaid, did that in behavioral mental health. And while, you know, it's advantageous for funding your work, it has a lot of limits on how many times you can come in and service access. And I didn't want that.
Okay.
And so our clients have the ability to come to as many groups per week as they want, as often as they want, get as many sessions with social workers. And I think in that organically, that relationship piece, that trust building piece, and the social emotional development is happening more quickly because they're around us more often and they're around.
You can see that. You can see the
yes.
person. They have this opportunity. You can see them growing into it and becoming more comfortable.
That's right. You know, there's kind of feedback of like, this is my community. This is like my family, because they're starting to get comfortable with our team and then each other. And then they've had to learn conflict, right? Like, they don't like each other, their anger response. How do we productively express how we're feeling instead of cutting each other down or getting into it? So we've been able to just have those experiences with the people we serve and just help them through that process. But then they also have a sense of community that they're able to build and feel a part of, which is also part of their healing.
And are they finding, like you said, community, are they finding it also in other victims in some of these group settings as well?
Right. I mean, that's part of it, right? Relatability is always a part of our healing process. And so it was interesting. Some of the groups I'll hear, you know, maybe a domestic-born trafficking victim is with a refugee trafficking victim or a refugee who went through some really horrifying traumas. And it's interesting to hear each of them say the other inspired the other, you know, because they can't imagine going through what the other went through and the resiliency. And so that's a really neat exchange, you know, for them to be able to see. And it's also really neat now that we've been around a while, we also don't put limits. So we have clients who've been with us for years and seeing how they've come really far along and can now speak a little bit of encouragement into the newer clientele. And that's also a really neat piece, even with the youth, you know, to see that some of the youth that are actually graduating out of our teen program, they're turning 19, 20 and, you know, moving into the adult programs, but then also able to see where they've come from as a teen and now what they're doing as adults is really neat.
It's interesting to hear you say that sometimes the victims or clients, we want to call refer to them as that, inspire each other. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, though, how about for you and your team? Does that you find inspiration in what you hear and see?
Yeah. I mean, I think without that, I don't know if we'd all be able to keep doing the work.
Yeah.
You know, it's a heavy work, right? It's a heavy work. There's a lot. We could spend 20 hours on one client just resourcing and helping stabilize. You know, they've been through a lot. So the population can have, they bring a lot into a room, into a session. And, you know, there's a lot of systemic things people are always trying to overcome. You know, we're functioning within a system that's not always able to assist our clients the way we'd hope. You know, so there's all these things that staff and the team are experiencing. And so when they see somebody accomplish something significant or hear the feedback that individual is really progressing because of the care of our team, yeah, that's very inspiring for us.
And that's what helps you.
Propels our work.
Keeps you going.
Absolutely.
Because I'm sure, like you said, it's got to come with its own mental health challenges,
right.
Enduring and kind of living in that world where obviously things are not fair at all, right?
That's right.
Let's take a time out here and we'll come back with more on what's next. We're talking with Julie Palmer. She's the executive director of People Against Trafficking Humans. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Experience the vision of Buffalo's fashionistas as they display their style. FIG, an evening of fearless fashion, takes place on September 28th at Seneca One. Buffalo's burgeoning designers will present their designs and lead the evening's performances. Ticket information and details about the designers at figbuffalo.com.
Explore the Underground Railroad's final stop. Learn about how the Latine workforce organized to overcome discrimination and follow the timeline of immigration in Western New York.
So remember, history surrounds you and includes you.
Watch Compact History on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. together we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next here on WBFO. Our guest, Julie Palmer, Executive Director of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. You know, Julie, as we're going through the first part of our conversation, you touched on a couple of really interesting things, and maybe a chance for us to expand on it a little bit. But trauma-informed care. Mm-hmm. You mentioned this. I've heard this. I guess in some ways, the understanding of it is inside the term itself. But expand on it a little bit, mm-hmm. and how it informs some of the things that you're doing with at your agency.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at trauma-informed care, the really major component of it is looking at what happened to that person instead of asking why they act that way. It's just a whole different way of seeing someone, right? Okay. And I always joke, like, I have to try to use it more with my kids because, you know, as a mom, you're like, why are you like this?
Well,
my one son is like, you never use your counseling on us. I'm like, no, because I have to live with you. Yeah. And I'm not feeling trauma-informed right now. You're just getting on my nerves.
Very, very nice.
But, you know, it's a concept we can really use in our everyday life, to be honest. I find that the model is very advantageous for trauma, but also just everyday life, because the reality is, and the premise is, all of us have experienced trauma, right? Trauma encompasses all sorts of things. It could be a loss, it could be a divorce, it could be a national disaster, it can be a victimization, you know, it could be a job change. I mean, it could be when you were a kid, you moved around 10 times, you know, those things create an illicit trauma within each of us, right? And when we look at trauma, it's what's notably distressing to anyone, right? It doesn't mean you have to have had mental illness, doesn't mean you're a person that can't cope. It just means whatever the event was, it would be distressing to anybody who experienced it. And the other piece of trauma is whether it's chronic or acute, right? So is it a one-time event, something happened to you, and then how you process that versus your daily or regularly living out a trauma event? That's going to also affect how people engage, how they react, how they function in society. So that's what we're looking at. The other piece of trauma-informed care is they've established what they call ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences.
Okay.
And I see it more and more now being incorporated. I noticed my kids are taking the surveys in schools. So in that process, there's a survey form. I can't remember how many questions, maybe 10 to 20. And you just check a box if you experienced it during your childhood. And then, unfortunately, the more boxes you check, the more you could end up having adverse experiences in adulthood, how that carries into your development in adulthood. And so they're looking at that more now in the school systems and in systems working with young people to see if maybe there's a way we can try to engage while they're at that age to see if there's something more we could do to prevent that trauma from furthering. You know, it's not a perfect science. It's
right.
Definitely going to take a lot of time. But I think we're on to something in the sense of how we see things happening to people. And one of the things I found most interesting is how trauma affects our brain and what that does to our brain, our neurological development, how we can actually have spaces where it kills, you know, cells, neuron changes. But the good news they discovered is that you can reverse some of that damage to a healthy. And so they're looking at now, how do we reverse
physically?
That?
Like,
there's certain types of cognitive psychological therapeutic approaches that can actually rewire some of our neurotransmitters and heal some of that in our brain, which is super fascinating.
Right.
It's a lot of work though. And somebody'd have to be really willing to go into some real intensive cognitive therapies. But they are seeing some of that, just even how people think, phrases you tell yourself in your mind, how you see yourself, just all our self-talk has a lot of impact.
Mm.
And so part of the work is working with people in identifying first, they need to feel safe. They need to have trust, right? They need to have choice and strengths, right? We have a strengths-based approach when we engage our clients because often when somebody is a trauma victim or somebody's going through things or they've experienced a lot, they may have unhealthy coping strategies, mental health issues. And we tend to look at that person as if this is who they are and there's nothing innately, you know, in them that they have capacity or strength or talent to do. And I think all of us have some talent, capacity, ability, strength. It's how we bring that out after it's been so suppressed by all the things that have happened to people. And so some of our assessment tool asks, you know, what do you think you're good at? What are things you enjoy doing? What's a strength somebody's acknowledged in you? What are strengths you, what are goals you want to accomplish? Because it helps somebody start seeing things in a whole different way about their life and who they are. And it just takes a lot of work, though. And I think some of the, you know, I do a lot of reading and researching what other organizations across the country are seeing and doing. And one interesting fact was, you know, often we try to get, housing and jobs, right? Like that's what society by and large says, this is what they need. But one of the big things now research is saying is, what about the trauma? What about the healing time people need so they can hold a job?
Right.
You know, so they can handle housing. So I think we're doing more better work at kind of looking at all those components and giving people those restorative processes.
I want to, there's so much in this conversation that I want to continue to explore, but just to step back, when you're, you know, dealing with a victim of human trafficking, one of, and you're going through these, you know, probably in many cases, some very lengthy work researching, understanding, you know, trying to get people to open up. Are you finding connections to some of the victims, you know, some of these trauma from childhood? Is there a connection that we can make there? Or, and I guess I don't want to make it to be too general, but at the same time, I'm just very interested in this idea of a trauma-informed care.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say a large majority of the people we served experienced trauma in their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give a percent, but I would say it's 90% or more.
Okay.
You know, life circumstances tend to leave vulnerability in people, you know, and that's what perpetrators look for. They're looking for the vulnerability, right? You know, if they see a confident, successful person with lots of supports and resources, they're not going to be as easy to entice into something. Now, doesn't mean it hasn't happened to people that fit that category, but perpetrators tend to want to do what's easy and what's, you know, easy to manipulate, easy to coerce. And so we do a lot of trainings in school districts.
Okay.
That's one initiative we started about 4 or 5 years ago. And actually, we just recently got asked, that schools are already starting. We already started getting the asks because, you know, we've been in districts now every year, which has been a wonderful thing to get to the student body. But just looking at that and looking at that impact in our community and how people are being engaged in it and how easy it is for a simple text message, a simple solicitation on social media, that they can just, they're looking, right? And we tell faculty, my husband's actually a teacher, and he's like, you know, we're not trained to understand all these dynamics, and especially post-COVID, now they're supposed to understand social-emotional impact and all this stuff in the classroom. And to be fair to the faculty, I say, you know, let us do the intervening. Let us do the work with them. Just identify if you see that vulnerability. You know, you see that kid on the fringe who's not hanging around anybody. They're always isolated. You see a kid who's starting to change their looks and their appearance. You see a kid that's acquiring a lot of money and means all of a sudden. You see a kid who's hyper-vigilant on their phones. You're hearing, you know, posts on social media, sexualization, you know, there's little things I think any of us can see, even in our youth around us. People can identify and recognize, is your kid socially isolating? Are they overly engaged with somebody on their device? Are they somebody trying to groom them and get them to meet, get them to date, get them to think they can make good money? And there is realities that sometimes there is that, hey, I'll give you this if you go do this. We've had adults and youth tell us that they'll have a Cash App, a Venmo, some type of account, and somebody will randomly send them $100 with a message that says, come meet me here and I'll give you more money.
Wow.
They're willing to give up that $100 in the hopes that that person needs money and they'll go do whatever is needed. And unfortunately, it does work. Some of our clients have said they've responded to it because they desperately needed resources.
Wow.
So there's just all these unbelievable ways that we can be engaged. And so what we say is, you can't be afraid of it. phones are part of society. We don't go into presentations and with schools and tell kids not to use it. They'll laugh us out of the room, right? It's their culture. But we talk about how you can be smart. You know, and I have four kids and three of them are teens, and we have the same conversations in our house. You know, our dinner table is open dialogue. I think that's part of it. Let's not, you know, and our generation, none of this existed when we were teens, right? There was no phones. There was no internet. There was no this communication. Like our kids joke, my one son's like, well, what phone did you use? What did you do to talk? You actually had to like roll the road.
How did you make plans?
Like cordless phones were a huge, exciting thing when we were kids, you know? And so it's just a different culture. And so it's trying to understand what they're living in. And I think that's hard as a parent because you want to protect your kids. You don't want to see them fall into the traps of the phones. But I also see needing to step back and just say, this is their reality. And it's something we've never encountered in society. So we have to approach it a little bit different. You know, like one thought is I've said to my kids, well, what do you think is a reasonable amount of time you should be on a phone? What do you think is a reasonable time we should turn it off at night? Because if they're not part of the conversation, this is their world, right? Yeah. So it's like talking
part of their
about
identity.
How do you be in that world, but have it in a healthy way? You know, one simple, there's a little video that came out. We're partnered with Love 146, which is a national child exploitation curriculum that we've got an agreement with that we can do in the community. And it's excellent. And it's very relevant to kids. It's not for victims necessarily. It can be for, you know, prevention measures. And there's a whole video, it's like 30 seconds of a kid that basically just says to kids, did you know when you load a social media app, most of them are public, that they do not automatically put on your privacy settings. What a simple, easy tool.
Right.
Right. If we just get that communicated out there. Hey, you load an app, go in and turn on your privacy settings. That's like one easy tool, right? Because the reality is we don't think about it. Even adults don't.
Right.
We're putting our stuff out there all the time and nobody's realizing who's looking at it. And so it's just that conversation. Hey, there's people looking at stuff. There's people trying to find things. Let's not give them that opportunity. You know, there's ways we can protect ourselves. So it's those kinds of conversations.
I'm interested about the conversations that go on in the schools. You're more and more, you're getting these presentations, you're into more schools.
Mm-hmm.
What are you hearing from students? It's got to be
eye-opening. Well, it's interesting because we try to be interactive, right? You know,
right.
Students, you know, and I joke with teachers. I'm like, you know what? I have a whole new respect when we've had to present 8 periods or 6 periods, the same thing in a row all day. I'm like, wow, I don't know how you do this every day. This is like a groundhog moment. So bless them for that, what they do. But we've had, you know, conversations, one of the questions we'll ask is how many people in the room can 100% tell us with 100% certainty that you know everyone you're affiliated with on social media? And rarely does a kid raise their hand, which I find fascinating.
Wow.
So they know that.
And they know that some of these,
they know that they can't guarantee they know
right.
everybody.
And they know these people they're gaming with, they know that they don't know them, is what you're saying.
Right. Any, yeah. There's social media affiliates, follows, likes, they're realizing it's just that acknowledgement that, yeah, I don't actually know everybody I'm affiliating. You go on a gaming, an internet game where you can chat, you know, Fortnite example, you can chat. I've said to them, how many of you feel like you know 100% certainty that person you're chatting with isn't actually a 48-year-old man? How do you know? Or a woman? How do you know?
What are the looks on the faces? What are the responses when you say that?
They're engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the teachers will like send us emails after like, this was great. They're so engaged, you know. So it's important. I think, again, it's part of culture. Right. And we hand a kid a phone and nobody's really schooling it. Right. Nobody's saying, well, here's things to know. Right. We're in a society. Because, again, most parents don't know. Right. You're hearing the whole movement across the country now where they're trying to get phones out of schools and the parents are nervous. Right. Because we've become accustomed to immediate contact, immediately being able to know where my kid is. It's become very important to us. And I understand that because we've had a lot going on in our society. Right. I honestly look at my find the phone on my a couple times a day, make sure my kids are where they're supposed to be. I hear that as a guardian, you know, but there is also a reality that we've maybe done something that we're trying to undo, right? And so how do we do that? How do we get ourselves in a really healthy, safe space for our kids and all that's going on?
Do you find also with your conversations with parents and such, I would think they're also equally fascinated in some of the things that you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think it's a mix a little bit. I think almost, it's like anything in society, people almost just don't want to know because it would feel like too much to navigate, right? Like if we actually thought about and knew everything that our kids or we can all be exposed to, that could overwhelm. So I just really try to encourage people, do the simple things. You know, we were asked to speak at a charter school and just for parent night and just said, listen, I'm a parent. Like it can overwhelm, but just do what you can. You know, you buy your kid a phone, buy a family sharing plan. You can log into their iCloud and see what they're doing. You can put controls on their phone and shut it off. You can control how often they're on YouTube. You can control whether they can load an app. You know, just be a little more proactively engaged. Talk to your kid. Who are you chatting with? You know, who have you gotten to know? What's been going on in social media? What's the newest thing? You know, sometimes I just even ask, you know, if they're watching a reel, what's your reel about? You know, what's going on? And because honestly, I don't sit around and have time to do it, but right. I'm curious, what are my kids experiencing and being exposed to? You know, you can even put on the phone's ratings so that they can't load a YouTube video or something after a certain rating scale. So there are things we can do.
Okay.
Right. If we hand a kid a phone, there's things we can do before we hand it to them. And then we have conversations. I say to my kids, never give out personal information. Don't give out your address, your date of birth, the social security number. There's no reason for anyone to ever ask you that. You know, in your address, somebody wants to hang out, you say, well, my mom needs to talk to your family or whatever you got to say, or, you know, I'll get, you know, we'll meet at a public spot. You know, some of it's just teaching your kids about smart thinking, smart engaging.
And just to make the point of the case, because we hear our talking about human trafficking, the connection between those phones and young people becoming victims of human trafficking.
Yeah, federal law enforcement, it's come out of several federal agents' mouths over the years that the internet and the social media is the number one ground, right? And it makes total sense. It's what society's doing. And it unfortunately also has a place to be underground.
Right.
You know, so it makes sense that's the number one mechanism.
We'll take a break on that note. We'll come back and hopefully have a couple of more positive notes when we finish our conversation with Julie Palmer today on What's Next. Julie is the Executive Director of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. We'll take a time out. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Hey, y'all. Corey here. Compact Civics is now in session. I want to talk about a hot bench issue, whether judges should be appointed or elected. In early U.S. history, all judges were appointed by elected officials. This long-standing tradition has led to some strong arguments for it. Here's an example. Elections might pressure judges to reveal their positions on laws, violating ethics. Judges must remain impartial, and what they need to care about is knowing legal codes from front to back. Then there's the other side of the bench. Some judges favor elections because they are seen as more transparent and democratic, avoiding behind-the-scenes deal-making. They can also enhance diversity. For instance, an African-American woman noted she might not have been appointed judge in an environment led predominantly by white men. Research shows that elected judges are more responsive to public opinion and also tend to be more punitive, especially towards minority defendants. However, whether electoral pressures impact judges' behavior remains an open question. In New York, there's a hybrid approach. Judges are chosen through partisan elections, allowing candidates to run under multiple party designations. So, New York's motto kind of offers an interesting middle ground. More choice, more voice.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. Our guest, Julie Palmer, Executive Director of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. And, you know, Julie, we've taken a lot of turns in this conversation, but as we're, you know, coming down here in the final, you know, 10 minutes or so, I really want to get back to one part that I find so encouraging about what you brought up about your work, and that this idea of we have people who have been victimized, people who have been victimized with human trafficking in ways that are unconscionable. We've touched upon, you know, some of the many things, whether it's sex work or forced labor. But this idea of working now with this person to find their assets. There's a certain kind of encouragement that comes from that. I'm interested in that process. What you have seen, what your staff has seen when you've tried to engage in that.
100%. And that's where the hope comes in. You know, we do an event every year, actually in July. July 30th is World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. So we just had our event and we call it Inspiring Hope. Because I think our community and society has heard a lot of, there's been a lot of difficulty in our society, a lot of things going on. And so we don't always want to keep hearing all these bad things. But what I like to encourage is there's a lot of hope. And we've served almost 1,000 people and we've seen some of those people with their lives different now than they were a few years ago. And that's the hope, and the hope in the community of, you know, now we see people we've helped get an education. You know, one asked us to help fund some of her college because she, of her circumstance, defrauded on loans. And so we gave her a kickstart, and then she's, you know, finishing her diploma, getting her bachelor's, and, you know, seeing people get into work situations and feeling productive, you know, able to accomplish something, you know, seeing people who came to us, I mean, a teen who came to us probably never saw anything so significant to this, where she was just could not be high, was going in the bathroom getting high, couldn't sit with other clients, had to only sit with the staff in a room, you know, homeless, you know, being, you know, sexually exploited. And it was years of process, step by step, just sitting in a room with her, right? I remember that the first very thing she was willing to do was to draw her words and what she was feeling. She couldn't even articulate it verbally. And that's how she started. And then years later, you know, sober, not on the hard drugs anymore, you know, employed, you know, but it was years of work. But there's hope in that, right? That if we walk alongside and we just stay present and continue to guide and direct people, they have some hope that there's a strengths within them. And we talk about that. I mean, we have a client, I love her. She's really been through a lot. She's really, you know, had a lot of exploitation, you know, is getting employed, you know, sometimes struggles through, but she loves art therapy.
Okay.
And she will make a point to bring to my office whatever she created in art therapy. It so fascinates me that it's so important to her that I see and acknowledge what she did. You know, that's just always struck me, because not all, some of my clients will do that, but she does it every time.
Okay.
And so just every time being able to say, that is beautiful work. Tell me about what you created. She just smiles. You know, there's like a little, just that acknowledgement, just that saying, hey, you've accomplished something and I see you. You know, we had one individual tell us one time, she'd been with us a really long time, and I could just tell one day she was off. So I grabbed her to the side and I just said, you okay? I just sensed something that you were off. And she started sharing things. 2 months later, she came to me and said, I just want you to know that few minutes you took for me to acknowledge I wasn't doing well did so much for me, because it showed that I was seen, and most people don't pay attention to that. And I was completely shocked by that. I mean, it was literally me just noticing something, taking a few minutes with that client. I had no idea how that affected her and what she did with that. There was another client years ago, that very beautiful 20s, and I just said, oh, you're a beautiful girl. And she looked up at me and said, nobody's ever said that
to
me.
Wow.
And I'm like, wait, you're in your 20s. She's gorgeous. How has no one, you know, it's just these things that we think they're so, to us, not real significant, but to the people we serve, just that hope and impact we can bring, kindness, right? Bringing value, encouraging them that they can do it. These are all things. And I give all the credit to my team. Between our staff and the volunteers we have close to 50 people engaged in our work. And those are the people that every day are investing. You know, no matter what their role is, they're investing. And I'm just really thankful for this group of people that is just passionately there to care and help build up and help people restore their lives. And so I think that's the hope our community can bring. Whether people want to volunteer, we have opportunity for that on our website. They can go right on our volunteer page and apply.
What would some of the opportunities? What would they be?
So we have our enrichment center, whether they want to serve clients coffee and snacks, help with meal preparation, transportation, assist with our
kids. What about the value
program
of those things? To me, those are gestures that might have long-standing
effect.
Unbelievable
gestures. If you're serving coffee and snacks, and when the client's signing in, you're the first person that greets them when they walk in the building. That's really key. Right, that could set a tone for a client's participation in group the rest of the time. You know, if you're sitting with our staff in a kids' room and just spending a minute investing in a five-year-old kid who's living a really traumatized life and just taking time with them. You know, if you're transporting our clients, they otherwise wouldn't get to our services. You know, so keeping our property upkeep so that they, you know, environment is one of the aspects of trauma-informed care. Feeling safe, cleanliness. I'm really big on that. Some might call it OCD. I just call it being neat.
Okay.
And so
let's talk to your kids about that. We'll say that
yeah,
for
well,
the show.
You know, they're over it. they're used to it. But I do think there's a lot to that. If you're traumatized, you're anxious, you have mental health, and you walk in a space that doesn't feel safe or look orderly, I think that adds to your anxiety. And so that's the simple things we can do that we don't even realize that impact on our client experience. You know, people donate meals. We give out 100 meals a week. Maybe you don't have time to volunteer. You don't have resources to give, but you can bring in once a month, you know, meals to hand out. Maybe people don't have time for that, but they can give resources. We can donate on our website. You know, we're really blessed and fortunate because the building we're in, we're on Delaware Avenue, corner of Delaware and Utica. It's a 2-story, 6,000 square foot building that a philanthropist in Western New York purchased for us.
Wow.
We are in it rent free. Our overhead is relatively low. So when people contribute to our organization, most of that funds goes directly toward programming support of the victims we serve, which is such a wonderful thing to be able to say thanks to this donor. So this is how people can really bring hope. Have us come in and speak. I have staff, myself, we go in and speak all types of organizations, groups, schools, churches, you know, businesses. Have us, the more your community knows, the more they can identify and do something, or more they can get engaged in supporting the work. So there's lots of ways we can do something and feel hopeful in it.
And have you seen results from some of these talks? Like you go in you've seen it and then... You know, maybe
either people donate, we've seen people get a volunteer, we get tips now.
Right. That's
because, you know, they hear about it, they learned what to look for. We've had tips and some of them were real cases. Some of them are actually being investigated now by law enforcement. So never underestimate what you identify in a community. And we say you're not wasting our time. I mean, you can email us, you can call, we have a 24-hour cell, text, phone line. I mean, you're not wasting our time because we just forward it on to the people that can do that investigative work. But yeah, we've had community members identify scenarios.
What, because we're coming down to the last couple of minutes here. So what are the things, what can people look for that are worth their red flags or at least
indicators?
Yeah, yeah, indicators.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a lot of the things we were talking about with youth, isolation, people acquiring expensive things, people feeling controlled by someone, their IDs being confiscated, they're living at the place of employment, they're being controlled by a phone, maybe. They always have to make sure they check in with somebody. Teens dating somebody that's quite a bit older. We see branding tattoos. We're seeing a lot more of that.
Branding tattoos?
Yeah, branding of names, gangs, you know, kind of this is my person, this is my girl. You know, we're seeing a bit of that, or my guy who we're controlling. You know, frequent pregnancies, STDs, you know, change in personality, withdrawal out of school, you know, dynamics at home, you know, the workplace change. So I think there's quick things, hotel key cards, you know, they have a whole bunch of them. AWOL, I hear that a lot. Teens are gone for weeks at a time, don't know where they are. You know, adults that seem like things were going really well and suddenly there's all this change. You know, I think there's things that people can quickly acknowledge, not speaking on their own behalf. We had a community member at a kiosk in the mall and was talking to a girl, and the guy intervened right in the middle of their conversation and said, "I'll speak for her." Huge red flag, right. You know, huge indicator. So those are just things we can simply see. One I learned in a training was if you see more workers and certificates on a wall for a massage parlor, nail salons, hair salons, those can be indicators something's going on. You see something in your own community. We're getting calls now in neighborhoods that there's solicitations, there are escort services, people going in and out of a house all day long, you know, things that you're seeing that don't seem typical. Right. There was a massage parlor in one community that people started feeling like there was stuff in the back room happening, some engagement going on. And now, you know, that turned into an investigation. So I think there's stuff our community can be aware and pay attention and have an impact. And I would just say to get involved, you know, the best place to find us is on our website, pathofwny.org. So pathofwny.org. That's where you can get our phone line. If somebody's in an emergency, you can click right on the phone. You can email. You can go to our volunteer page. You can donate. We have job opportunities posted. So that's a great place to just find anything you're looking for us and get involved.
Julie Palmer, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us and giving us some real insight and some options as well. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Julie Palmer, Executive Director of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.